again, everyone. This is Mark Movsesian. I'm the co-director of the Center for Law and Religion at St. John's. I'm joined once again by my friend and colleague, the center's other co-director, Mark DiGirolami, the other Mark, for another episode of Legal Spirits, which is our podcast series on cases and issues in law and religion. You can find past episodes archived on our website, lawandreligionforum.org, and also on Apple iTunes and on Android. Well, today we're going to have a guest in with us. We're planning on interviewing Sohrab Ahmari about his just-released book, The Unbroken Thread, Discovering the Wisdom of Tradition in an Age of Chaos. Now, this is a real treat for us for a few reasons. Sohrab, who edits the opinion page of the New York Post, is an influential journalist of what we might think of as the new conservative school, which differs, often quite profoundly, from establishment conservatism, and which differs precisely on the value of tradition for law and politics. There's much ferment in conservatism these days, and Sohrab is a very prominent representative of one side of the debate. Now, Sohrab's new book is about the continuing value of tradition. And this, of course, was the focus of our center's Tradition Project, a three-year research project on just what received wisdom continues to offer for us today. And listeners, you can learn more about that project on our website. Sohrab, it's a real pity you didn't write this book before, because we could have used you in the project. Sohrab's book is very readable and fills a real need in public discourse today. And Sohrab really knows how to tell a story. It's really a great book. We enjoyed it, and we look forward to speaking about it with you today. So our roadmap for this episode is this. We're going to ask Sohrab to introduce himself and briefly state the main themes of his book. And then Mark and I will ask Sohrab some questions about what his book raised, some questions that his book raised for us. And these are some of the same questions that came up in the Tradition Project, because as we'll see, tradition is a very complicated thing that sits uneasily with the dominant discourse in our politics and culture. Okay, so we're really looking forward to this. Mark, I'll turn it over to you.
Wonderful. Well, Sohrab, permit me to offer my welcome as well. It's really, as Mark said, a treat for us to have you with us. So perhaps you might start just, you know, we have just a few sort of framing questions about the book for our listeners, about the motivation for the book, the structure of the book. So the first question that both of us had, and we both remarked on this, Mark and I did, as we were reading the introduction and the sort of lead up to the main body, is that you structure the book and you include in could be called the epilogue of the book, a letter to your son, Max, who's not infant, but I think he's probably either a toddler or getting out of the toddler stages. And maybe you might let listeners know a little bit about that, about the motives for the book and about the sort of more personal, including the more personal reasons for your writing this.
Yeah, well, thank you, Mark and Mark. I've never been on a podcast where both the hosts are named Mark, although I know there's a slight letter difference between the two, a spelling difference. But it's a pleasure to be with you. I know both of you on Twitter. I know Professor Movsesian from real life as well. It's nice to meet the other Mark, at least by remotely. Thank you for having me. This is a book. As you know, the word tradition has a Latin root, traditio, to hand on. And this is a book that was born of my anxieties about what I would be handing on to my son, Max, who's now 4 years old. He was two when I started writing the book. And not just what I would be handing down to him, but what our wider culture would hand down to him. And this was something that I never pondered in my 20s when I was unmarried and childless. You know, I began my career in journalism at the Wall Street Journal in a very kind of typical conservative, you could even say neoconservative. I am an immigrant to the United States. I was born and raised in Iran. And it felt to me like the American promise had been fulfilled for me and then some. We immigrated when I was 14 years old when we first landed. My mother and I initially lived in the trailer court. And then within a decade, here I am editing the European edition of the Wall Street Journal based in London, and mobile and dynamic, and everything seems fine. But then, three things happened. I got married. I converted to Roman Catholicism, which is a different story. I told in my memoir, And then we had our first child, Max, who's in some ways the addressee in this book, the first reader of this book, even though he wouldn't be able to make sense of it now. And all of those made me say, reconsider all of those certainties about a society that puts a great deal of emphasis on cultural dynamism and change, on a society that puts emphasis on personal choice and autonomy as supreme goods, or maybe the highest goods, and made me think that, I'm not sure that's good for my son. As I became a father, your point of view changes, I think. And so I had to hand on something else, or think about what would I hand down to him. And so I wrote this book because as I began to examine our world as it really is, and thinking about the kind of man that a society that just prizes, again, autonomy, choice, convenience, what kind of a person, you know, would be chiseled out of him by such a society. And so hence the genesis of this book. Very briefly, I mean, my Max is named after a Roman Catholic saint, Saint Maximilian Kolbe, who's famous as the saint of Auschwitz. He was a Franciscan friar who was obviously rounded up by the Nazis, and he someone from his punishment block or prison block escaped. And what the authorities at Auschwitz did was that whenever someone escaped, 10 other prisoners would be picked to die of starvation as a kind of retribution for the one escapee. And St. Maximilian Kolbe was in such a prison block, someone escaped. And, you know, the camp commandant came and picked 10 men. He did not pick St. Maximilian, but he heard another one of the men who was picked to die. He heard the man say, "My wife, my children," and St. Maximilian, stepped forward from the line, and the commandant asked, you know, "What does this Polish pig want?" And he said, "I want to take this man's place because he has a wife and children." So to me, that was, you know, this kind of act of freedom, of true freedom, that differed markedly from the account of freedom that prevails in the West today. And my anxiety is that by naming my son after Maximilian, I wanted to tie him to that deeper tradition that informed that act of supreme freedom, of true freedom, of laying down one's life for a stranger. But just naming is not enough. And you have to think about how you shape his worldview in a thoughtful way, so that he begins to reconsider our age's certainties about what makes for a good life, and perhaps to look back at the goods that are secured by tradition widely understood. So that's the personal genesis of this book.
That's very helpful, Sohrab. And in fact, it makes me think, is obviously the book is about tradition, but it's about the other major issue that we deal with here at the Center for Law and Religion, which is religion. So it's not just or exclusively about tradition, but it's tradition understood within a particular kind of context, with a particular sort of orientation. And in fact, the structure of the book proceeds really, I think it's fair to say, in two kind of general categories, what you describe as the things of God and the things of humankind. And for each of the chapters that you have within those broader sections, you rely on a historical figure. So for example, in the chapter about how a person defines their life, you rely on the life and experiences of C.S. Lewis, and you tell a sort of a story about his life forms a major part of that chapter. In the chapter on being spiritual but not religious, which we have some more questions about later, you talk about the lives of the anthropologist Victor and Edith Turner. And in the chapter about whether God respects you, you describe the very interesting life that I actually had not known about, of Howard Thurman. And so a question that arose is, two questions, I suppose. One is, how did you decide on this particular kind of structure? And then more broadly, the structure that you did pick seems to suggest something about the universality of the value of tradition. So the choice of method seems to be sort of underwritten by a kind of substantive view about the subject that you're attacking or the subject that you're trying to think about. And I wonder if you might say a little bit about that.
Sure, happily. So about how the structure came about, I confess, you know, as usual, these things are more accidental than one might otherwise imagine. So as these questions were percolating in my mind about how to try to form my son over against the cultural atmosphere that I felt might deform him, I first thought about writing a book of reportage as a kind of a more like of a journalistic exercise, because I've situated myself within a broader movement that goes by the kind of internet name trad. You know, I saw among my own generation, not everyone, it's not a mass movement, but a subset of young, you know, younger millennials and Zoomers. I'm 35, so I'm an older millennial, you know, where you, I had friends who were, you know, Yale graduates off to do, you know, do finance, and then suddenly they decided to become Orthodox rabbis, and they immigrated to Israel and went to yeshiva, or Roman Catholics like myself who have an interest either in the traditional Latin mass, so the church's pre-Vatican II liturgy, and or often also an interest in the church's social and political teaching, you know, from the 19th century, beginning of the 19th century. So I wanted to do a book of like that, where I'm more of an observer and I tell the stories of young people like this. And so I went to my agent, and my agent said, well, that sounds like a long magazine article. It doesn't sound like a book. So you should really just make a case for tradition. And he introduced me to an editor at Random House, and we jumped on the phone and we began talking. And I said, you know, look, there are moments where I think about my son, and there are questions that are raised for me as a human being, as a father, as a husband, that I don't think our age even asks. And so this editor, Derek Reed, said, well, maybe you should write a book of questions, of unasked questions. And then he suggested that, you know, instead of me kind of propounding my thoughts in relation to each question, that I would focus on one great thinker for each one. And so that's how the book came about. So it's a little bit more accidental than all that, and it's a kind of mind meld between me, my agent, and the publisher of the book.
Well, this is very interesting. So we're gonna return. I think I have a suspicion that we're gonna return to the issue of the particular and the universal with respect to some of the questions that Mark will ask. But why don't I turn it over to him for some more particular things? But thank you. That was very, very interesting.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mark. So Sohrab, I want to ask you about a paradox in your book. Your book argues that tradition, that is received wisdom and permanent ideas and deference to transcendent authority, that all this offers real world benefits in our contemporary culture, which is one that, as you say, is based on personal subjectivity and individual choice. And I think there's a lot to that. I think there's a lot to what you say. But there is a paradox, and that is, in our culture, tradition cannot be anything but a personal subjective choice. So unlike, let's say, your great-grandmother in Iran, who took established tradition as a given, a 21st century American can't just live tradition. Tradition is a choice like any other. One has to choose affirmatively to adhere to it. So in Charles Taylor's terms, the frame of our imagination has shifted. You know, it's simply impossible psychologically to think of tradition as the way that things must be done. So let's take your own story as an example of this. And by the way, we should make it clear to our listeners that you discuss this in your book. You write, I'm quoting now, I made a conscious, deliberate decision to submit to tradition. I chose to work my way back, to grasp at the thread until I could feel the fabric it was part of in the palm of my hands, which is, by the way, beautiful writing. I mean, great writing. And I think your story that you describe would resonate with many Americans who choose tradition. I mean, you were just talking a little while ago about, you know, secular Jewish kids who become observant. Or I think about our mutual friend, Rod Dreher, who became an Orthodox Christian. Or even our own stories, that is, Mark's and mine. We're not going to get into our stories here, but they're similar. And you know, perhaps the only way that someone in 21st century America can do this is to adopt for tradition as a personal commitment. So I guess here's the question. Your book is really a critique of liberalism, but isn't it precisely the possibility of choice that liberalism provides that allows people to do this, to choose a tradition or to switch a tradition? I mean, one of the people you write about is John Henry Newman, who chose Catholicism just as you did. So how do you resolve this paradox? Is it possible to do so?
So that's a very good question. And I would say it's one that intelligent readers of the book who have read the advanced copy always posed to me. And it's something that I was aware of, because I say in the book that, as you said, I chose to submit to a tradition. And I did that in the context of a liberal society. And then much of the book is really, sometimes explicitly, sometimes implicitly, is a critique of liberal assumptions about how to order society. And one immediate answer to give to that is that it's actually very hard, it's a hard paradox to resolve. And I don't make light of the fact that there is this tension between. On the other hand, here's what I would say is, it shouldn't have to be the case, because if you agree that there are important goods secured by tradition and for most of human history across most civilizations, then Cardinal Ratzinger, now Pope Benedict, wrote in his book Introduction to Christianity, most people across most of history look to tradition as this firm program that was handed down, and it made much of life easier for them, I would argue. We don't have the firm program, and so therefore we have to constantly reinvent the moral wheel. Every person has to decide in each situation, who am I? How should I act? What should I eat? What conflicts should I enter into? Which ones should I avoid? So on and so forth. And that's very exhausting. And so although my choice was one that is in some ways made possible by the kind of barrier-dissolving liberties made possible by kind of modern American society, including immigration, that's not enough for me to not have anxieties about the kind of world we've created. And I think that people shouldn't have to go through this gauntlet of tradition-dissolving kind of acidic forces that assail traditional wisdom and in every way make it difficult for people to pick it in order to get to something that is as valuable as tradition or traditions, plural. In my case, I mean, that's a different story I told in my conversion memoir, where, you know, I went through this and I became a Marxist and I became a postmodernist, and then eventually worked my way to be like, oh, okay, yeah, there are stable truths, and there are stable both spiritual and moral truths that are worth ordering my life around. And I think there's a kind of elitism embedded in that kind of view that says, well, people should just make their choice. Let me create a society that barrages them with confusion, pornography, you know, disorder in every way, and see if they can make it. That's not how historic Christianity ever thought about itself in terms of society. A choice has to be made that's absolutely free, uncoerced in any absolute at all way, and so you have to make a totally free choice. That's psychologically not realistic at all. Most people don't go through life that way, and so for the most part, traditions just made things easy in a way that I think is worthwhile. You know, there's some things that millennia of tradition concluded are true, and let's order society around it instead of saying, well, let's see, can you figure it out on your own, totally uncoerced, totally free? That's not how most human history worked, and I don't see why we can't reconsider how it is that we ended up where we are now.
I wanted to add something to that, sort of in support of Sohrab's position, but because it's not just from the sort of the point of view of modernity that, and I appreciate the paradox. I think it is a kind of paradox also, but also from the point of view of those bound by traditions in the past. You know, I'm not sure it's right to say that, you know, our great grandparents were just sort of unthinking recipients of the tradition that they were a part of, right? I mean, they exercised rationality. They decided to which parts of the tradition they were going to uphold, which parts they weren't. So there is this sort of assumption, I think, that especially in modernity, that tradition is unreasoned, right? That you're either a reasoning human being and making your own choices, or you're just a sort of a receptacle for the views and the attitudes and the practices of the past. And I think that actually that's not so either for the way that it was or the way that it is. One is always the way in which tradition binds is always with us, as is our reason. And these sort of things, they kind of work together. It's not necessarily true that there's a kind of opposition between what is reasoned and what is traditional. So I'm with Sohrab on this point as well.
Well, I think that's going to be a theme. From what I know of Mark and what I've read from Sohrab, I think that's going to be a theme. Well, let me ask about something a little different, and also ask about maybe another point of tension between me and Mark. It's been this way for quite some time, about whether it's appropriate to speak in terms of a tradition or in terms of traditions. Because let's come back to your story. So here you were, you went through various different things, you affiliated with various different ideologies and religions. And so you sort of reflect that in your book, I think. Your book brings together thinkers from a very wide variety of perspectives. We talk about Catholics, and there's Catholic, there's Jewish, Protestant, Muslim, Confucian. You even throw in Andrea Dworkin to give the feminist tradition. I suspect Andrea Dworkin would have been a little bit uncomfortable with your characterization of her as a traditionalist. And you justify all this by saying that your purpose is not to advocate for any one tradition, but to show that tradition generally offers an important critique of contemporary philosophy. I'm going to quote you again. You say, "Thoughtful followers of different traditions can find more in common with each other than any of them might with secular, liberal, technocratic modernity." And actually, I was thinking, you know, you have a chapter on C.S. Lewis. He actually said something like this in The Abolition of Man, I believe. He said, you know, if you look at the great traditions of the world, they are quite similar in a lot of ways. They really agree about many things. So, look, I think that is true. You know, if you want to talk about contemporary politics, I think traditionalist believers of various confessions tend to see eye to eye politically. And, you know, that more eye to eye with each other than they do with so-called reformist or modernist believers of whatever confession. But having said that, I want to ask this question, which is, aren't you perhaps discounting too much the differences among these traditions? I mean, is it really so easy to harmonize? Like, for example, you have both Confucius and you also talk about Aquinas and Augustine. Well, what would Confucius have to say to those men? I mean, Confucius famously said, "Why worry about the next life? You don't even understand this life." So metaphysics was out for Confucius. Mm-hmm. What would he really say to Augustine or to Aquinas? So this gets me down to my conflict with Mark, which is, shouldn't we talk about traditions rather than tradition? The original name of the project, Sohrab, was the Traditions Project, but Mark talked me out of it. So let's see where you come down on this debate.
I'm a Catholic, so I'll go with the you know, either and, you know. answer, which is that, you know, I'm a Roman Catholic, and so, you know, as you know, in the Roman Church, traditional with a capital T is one of four sources of authority, that inform faith all taken together, and so, you know, I think that tradition, I don't make light of the fact that I believe that tradition is, you know, with a capital T, is superior. It's a product of an institution. It's not a product, but an outgrowth of an institution that is divinely established, in my view. Nevertheless, also as a Catholic, I believe that obviously there is such a thing as natural wisdom that various peoples had access to without the benefit of divine revelation, and in so far as natural questions go. You know, non-Christians obviously came up with lots of things that are good and true, and a confident tradition with a capital T, can also look to these traditions and point out where there are agreements and where there are disagreements. There are big disagreements, by the way. So besides the one you mentioned, Seneca was entirely too comfortable with suicide. And of course, St. Augustine in the early a couple of books of the City of God, you know, condemns suicide as a sinful act. Howard Thurman despised or blamed almost all of kind of historic institutional Christianity as complicit with racism, whereas for John Henry Newman, the institutional church was, historic Christianity was the touchstone of orthodoxy. So it's true, and I think what I've tried to do in the book is to let those tensions just exist and breathe next to each other and let the reader make of it what they will. What I would say is there is a rupture, though, between all the traditions that I highlight in the book and the modern worldview that I seek to critique in the book. And that's, I think, what resolves the paradox, if I may. And the way that resolves the paradox is the fact that in all of them, the message of tradition is that to be bound is to be free. To negate yourself is actually to affirm what's best in you. To negate yourself as your sort of base appetites or desires. And so that you see the working out of that paradox in each chapter. So, in the Aquinas chapter, when reason and revelation each submit to the other, both are enriched. In the Sabbath chapter with Rabbi Heschel, what seems like a restriction, an imposition on what you can do with your free time, actually liberates you from the acquisitiveness and the kind of clamor and rivalries of daily life. And so with Seneca, accepting death as a kind of natural reality actually makes you not be constantly worried and anxious, as so many people have been over the past year, in some cases rationally, but in some cases to an inordinate, irrational degree. Accepting divine authority in political matters actually sets a limit on the what secular quote unquote power can do, and that's the kind of thread that binds all 12 together, despite all their differences. In each of them, you'll see there's something that appears like a restriction, but actually resolves itself as a source of freedom. Whereas what the modern world offers as the appearance of freedom, in fact, is imprisoning.
Yeah, I think that's a very helpful way of thinking about this longstanding disagreement. Is too strong, probably difference of opinion, but and not to borrow too much from liberal theory, but you know, liberal theory does have this idea of the difference between a concept and a conception, right? So you might think, well, there's a concept of tradition that is kind of universal or can bind these various, can sort of sew together these various threads. Even though we might think of different conceptions, particular cultural conceptions of tradition as emphasizing, let's say, you know, suicide in one case and the immorality of suicide in another, or so there can be variation within the individual conceptions, but there is something to a kind of general concept of religion that can be said that can be said usefully with respect to the larger idea, so to speak. But maybe another chapter that both Mark and I had our eye on for our discussion is your chapter about the spiritual but not religious chapter. And I think, Mark himself has written about this extensively, you know, what he's called, or other people have called, and he has diagnosed or discussed as the rise of the nuns in our culture, which is to say those who are spiritual but have no religious tradition or no longstanding, no traditional tradition, one might say. And so in the chapter that you have on this, you talk about the view that it is not just possible, but even preferable today to be spiritual, but not religious. And one of the things that you discuss in that chapter is the human need for ritual, again, perhaps part of the concept of tradition, even though the rituals vary. And that certainly rings true. I was reflecting about the fact that in law, there's a kind of old jurisprudential fight between formalists, what we call formalism, and realism. And, you know, today a lot of people take the realist side of things. It's important to be flexible and, you know, not to have too many forms, not to have too many sort of rules that structure your life. But it's also, I think, quite important to get our new law students to see the importance of forms, of what forms can do for you, that they can liberate certain kinds of behavior. They can show a kind of respect for other people that without forms is not possible. And it's particularly with respect to a pluralistic society like ours. But in your chapter, you say, look, ultimately, aside from the issue of ritual, what's important in religion, the concept of religion or the concept of traditional religion is kind of groupishness, that it's more than just you or more than just your choice. So spiritualism without that component of groupishness is essentially privatized. So just a sort of scattershot of variety of observations about that wonderful chapter. I wonder if you have any comments, you know, you want to add anything, Sohrab?
Yeah, I mean, what I argue isn't so much that even groupishness is paramount, because I guess people who get together to do yoga, yoga in its kind of faddish sense, not as a deeper tradition, they have the groupishness too. So they have ritual, and they have the elements of self-denial that many rituals involve. I mean, you're putting yourself in a hot room, and it's, you know, and you're doing the same thing, and it's physically... what's missing, I think, Victor and Edie Turner would argue, who are the subjects of that chapter and who are kind of paramount figures now in the anthropology of religion, is a shared account of ultimate meaning. So in other words, the people who call themselves spiritual but not religious do have some elements of ritual religion. They, you know, do salt baths, Dead Sea salt baths, and you know, self-deny and only eat bananas in these retreats and so forth. But they rule out the element where there's a kind of shared account of ultimate meaning that's been handed down, and which those rituals, for the truly kind of real ritual, is deeply bound up. So the Turners examine the ritual beliefs and practices of a Central South African people called the Ndembu, and every ritual element in their kind of shamanism has a kind of meaning, and that meaning is shared, and everyone understands what's happening. Now, you and I couldn't do that, but we don't see that process at work in private, what I would call privatized, what spiritualism or a spirituality without ritual. It's just every person can choose to do something, and you can tell that it's not that existentially important to them, because if I miss my spinning session, which is ritualistic for me, or even a spiritual outlet, I feel a little bummed out. I don't have the sense that I have to go to confession for having missed my spinning session.
Well, you might say, actually, Sohrab, this ties together. This really is very much like the theme you're discussing before, which is the real thing that distinguishes the traditional from the contemporary is the acceptance of an authority to whom one is accountable. And so all of these rituals are accepted by the nuns, by the spiritual, not religion. They're accepted simply as something that makes sense to them, that they have sort of created, but they don't feel that they are in some sense accountable to the deeper reality behind that. I'm not saying this is a criticism, just as a description. It would be simply, well, you know, it doesn't mean that for me, and it doesn't have to mean that for me.
That's right. Absolutely.
Okay, great. Well, so I think we should save time for another discussion, because we have a lot more to do here. So, but for now, let me just say, Sohrab, thank you very much for coming on. We really appreciated this, and we'll look forward to hear what our listeners have to say about it. We'll hope we'll have other conversations with you in the future.
Thank you very much, Mark and Mark.
Wonderful to have you.
So for now, this has been Mark Movsesian and Mark DiGirolami for Legal Spirits. You can find past episodes archived on our website, lawandreligionforum.org, and also on Apple iTunes and Android. See you next time.